Daniel chapter 5. There are copies at the back. You may have already seen them earlier today of the study questions for chapter 6. Again, we'll be covering that in a couple of weeks when we get back, but I don't know if you prefer to work ahead on those or work behind or how you prefer to do them, but we do have some additional information usually in those that we don't go over and so forth, and questions will help you to get the information down just a little better than just listening to the lessons. The drunken feast of Belshazzar, the writing on the wall, certainly a very unique event that John read for us just a few moments ago that takes place. As far as the time frame, several years have passed from chapter 4 to chapter 5. Again, in these first six chapters, we have six events that we're told of, and those cover a span of about 70 years. And so there's some time certainly taking place between them. But in the four chapters we've looked at so far, we've had Nebuchadnezzar as the king in all of those chapters. And by the time we come to chapter 5 then, Nebuchadnezzar's kind of disappeared from the scene. He is mentioned, but he has passed on from this world, and he's no longer the king. In fact, if you look back at history, there's been a couple of kings in between that reigned for fairly short periods of time after Nebuchadnezzar. And so at this, when we come to chapter 5, begins with King Belshazzar. And so we have a new person as king. We'll talk a little more about him in just a moment. But as we begin to break the chapter down, it begins with a feast, a drunken orgy, we might say, just a huge debacle of a feast with all kinds of things going on that certainly had no business going on. So it begins in verse 1. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So Belshazzar and his extravagant feast. But first of all, was Belshazzar a historical figure? Was he king? Well, the text tells us that he was, and so that's good enough for most of us, isn't it? And certainly should be good enough for us. But what does secular history say? Secular history, for a long time, and scholars and historians and so forth, had denied Belshazzar as an actual historical figure, because for a long time they couldn't find any mention of him in the Babylonian records. And again, they were people that kept pretty meticulous records. But as we've found more and more archaeological evidence, we have indeed found proof, in fact much proof, that Belshazzar was a real person there in Babylon. But was he king? That's a little bigger question, the idea that he was indeed king. Well, certainly Daniel presents him as king, doesn't he? Again, this chapter begins, King Belshazzar. He also calls him king in chapter 8, verse 1. In verse 30 of this chapter, he'll call him the Chaldean king. In chapter 7, verse 1, he calls him king of Babylon. Chapter 8, verse 1, he talks about the reign of King Belshazzar. And in fact, he will date things in chapter 7 and 8 from different events happening in the reign of King Belshazzar. And so certainly Daniel presents him as being king. But again, we go to the external evidence and archaeological evidence and so forth. All of the evidence that we find from the Babylonian record speaks of Belshazzar as son of the king, as opposed to the king himself. And as you look at that evidence, it seems that Nabonidus, who was Belshazzar's father, was actually the reigning king. It calls him king in the records and king of Babylon. And Belshazzar as the son of the king. But there is one particular record that shows where Nabonidus turned over, in essence, his kingship to Belshazzar because he was going to be leaving and going on a foreign campaign. And so he gives the responsibility, you might say, of the kingship to Belshazzar. It said he freed his hand, he entrusted the kingship to him. Then he himself undertook a distant campaign. And so he gives much of the responsibility to Belshazzar, and he goes on this campaign in Timah. And so, while as far as the legal documents of the nation were concerned, Nabonidus was the reigning king, Belshazzar was the functioning king. He's the one that was taking care of all of the kingly duties because his father Nabonidus was off on a foreign campaign. And so in essence you had theoretically or legally Nabonidus was the king and Belshazzar the son of the king. But practically Belshazzar was king. He's who the people looked to as king because he was functioning as king. Well, Nabonidus reigned as king from 556 to 539 B.C. 539 is when the Empire of Babylon is going to fall. And so we don't know exactly when in his reign that he gives over this power to his son and goes away on this foreign campaign. It's certainly clear that at the end, there in 539, which is the events that we're going to be reading about, that Belshazzar is acting as king. So, was Daniel giving an accurate record? And certainly he was when he calls Belshazzar king. Daniel is a book of history written for the people of God. It's not a legal Babylonian official document. Those documents say Nabonidus is king. But Daniel is writing history of God's people and deals with men whose decisions had a direct impact on those people, on those exiles that were there in Babylon. And that would certainly have been King Belshazzar. Because for all practical purposes, as far as the functioning of the nation, he's the man that they knew as king. Well, we'll address that just a little bit later whenever we get to promises that are made by Belshazzar. But let's move on. The feast and the disrespectful conduct that's taking place. The royal feast of oral antiquity were extravagant. We read about them not only in the Bible, but many historical documents record these great feasts that these kings of antiquity would oftentimes have. The word thousand here is probably not a literal thousand. It's just a number, a round number, showing the enormity of the feast. In fact, the historians, when they record the Medes and the Persians coming in and taking the city, they sound like everybody in the city was involved in this feast. So it could have very well been many thousands that were actually involved. But these were just huge blowouts, we might say, usually very immoral, usually much drinking going on. In fact, the drinking of wine was usually the main element of these feasts. It didn't focus as much on the food as it did on the drinking. And there's a lot of people seem to do that today. If you have a party and don't have a keg or something, there's a lot of people won't come. So it's kind of like a lot of people even are today. But the drunkenness with the wine, the lasciviousness with the concubines that's going on, certainly results in a drunken orgy. And so what's going on is certainly an insult to the God of heaven. It's an insult to Him in every way. Well, not only is that part an insult, but also we have very blasphemous and irreverent conduct going on as they bring these vessels. Now, whenever Nebuchadnezzar had gone in, remember on his third campaigns when he destroyed the temple, destroyed the whole city of Jerusalem, tore down the walls and so forth, but he got all of those vessels, all those, you go back and read Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, you read about all of those things that they made out of gold and silver and very precious things and had encrusted in them all kinds of jewels and all sorts of things. And so he got all that kind of stuff from the temple and the king's palace and so forth and brought it there. Well, Belshazzar is going to send them for these things for them to use in this drunken feast, to use as utensils. These were holy things that had been set aside for the worship of God there in Jerusalem, the worship of Jehovah. Well, as they bring these things out and he and his wives and his concubines are drinking from them, not only drinking from them, but while they're doing that, praising these other so-called gods, then you have something else that's very offensive to the God of heaven. And so this whole party that's going on is certainly an offense. The loss of the sense of things that are holy is always one of the signs of moral corruption and inward decay. We're seeing that in our nation today. The loss of a sense of things that are holy. And we're dealing with the consequences of it. That's what we have going on here in Babylon in the days of Belshazzar. Well, that brings us to the second point then, the distressed king. The handwriting on the wall, verses 5 through 12. First of all, we have a pale king, a king that's just scared out of his wits. And you can imagine him being, verses 5 through 6. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king's terror is brought about by this writing of an armless human hand. That'd get your attention, wouldn't it? You might look in that cup to see what he's drinking out of there. Yeah, when this hand appears and just starts writing on the wall. Well, we can see his result. His color changed. You know, I'm sure he went pale as a ghost. He's absolutely terrified. His limbs no longer have strength. His knees are knocking together. And so he cries out for his soothsayers, these wise men that we've seen throughout the book. They haven't been much help, it doesn't seem, but they keep going back to them. Verses 7 and 8. The king called loudly to bring the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler of the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. And so the king's offer, the third ruler of the country, he offers some fine purple clothing. And as we've often said, purple was the color of royalty. A gold chain around the neck, an ornament to be worn by a very prominent ranking person. And then third ruler. Well, from what we said a while ago, he couldn't really offer second ruler, could he? Because his father, Nabonidus, was really the first ruler. He's second ruler. And so he's offering the place underneath him, which would be third ruler. Some have tried to say he's offering here to rule over a third of the nation, but that doesn't really fit. He's offering to be the third in charge over the nation of Babylon, the empire of Babylon. Well, the reward is great, but the ability of the wise men is not. Again, we've seen that in every case where they've been called, haven't they? They just hadn't been able to come through yet. So once again, they're powerless to understand the writing on the wall. Now, if I understand this correctly, this was written in their language. I think they could see the words and knew what the words were that were there. But they don't have a clue what they mean. What's the interpretation? What's the message that's there? But it was written in their language, but they were powerless to have an understanding of what it is going on. Well, so they call these wise men. They're not able to help them. And so we have the perplexed lords, verse 9. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. Well, he's already been greatly alarmed once, hadn't he? And his color's already changed once. But now he's even more afraid. He had the initial reaction to this writing on the wall, but now that his supposed wise men could not tell him the answers as to what it meant, now he's all the more afraid. And so he, as well as his lords, those the noblemen, the other important people that are there with him, are frightened even more because these wise men cannot tell these things. The literal meaning of the perplexity of the king's guest is that is thrown into confusion. You know, his whole party is just becoming an uproar. I'm sure it became that pretty quickly when this hand's writing. And now as the events continue to unfold, it's just getting more and more out of hand. People are becoming more and more anxious and afraid as the night unfolds. Well, we have then coming on the scene a prudent queen. Verses 10 through 12. Finally, somebody with some answers shows up on the scene. It says, beginning verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. And the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems was found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. And so the queen shows up. Well, we've already been told back up in verse 2 that Belshazzar's wives were present at the feast, as well as his concubines. And so it seems that this is the queen mother. This is Belshazzar's mother, which was normally a very prominent position within these kingdoms of antiquity. But history tells us, I think we can you know with a fair degree of certainty, that this was a woman named Nitocris, who was the wife of Nabonidus, who again was Belshazzar's father. This would be Belshazzar's mother. And if we are correct in who it is, she was also the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And so that would throw Belshazzar, being Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, through his mother's side. Now again, if you go back through the history, there's been a couple of kings in between Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus, and I think some of that's explained in the handout for this chapter. But the queen, she knows some things that Belshazzar evidently doesn't. You know, whenever Nebuchadnezzar has died, and he and Daniel have got pretty close, But as he passed away, and you have a couple other kings there for a while, now you have Nabonidus and Belshazzar functioning as king. You know, what he knew about Daniel, or if he knew about him at all, we don't know. But certainly his mother remembered Daniel and the relationship that he had had with Nebuchadnezzar and the things that he had been able to do for Nebuchadnezzar by his God, Jehovah God. So, her being cognizant of these events of the past that Belshazzar probably was not aware of, or maybe had forgotten if he ever was aware of them, she's able to bring these things to his attention. Her position, again, is one of the highest in the royal palace. That was the common thing in these nations of antiquity, that these mothers, these queens, were held in very, very high esteem. In fact, we see in the text here that she enters the banquet hall of her own accord. She doesn't have to call and ask permission to come in or any of those type of things, which most people would have. But she just comes in and addresses the king, which very few people could do. Her language is likened unto that of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, verse 5. She speaks very highly of Daniel. Again, she had probably been around, maybe as a child, seeing some of those interactions between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. But she says that he has an excellent spirit. He's able to interpret. He has knowledge. He's able to solve riddles. He has understanding. He's able to give meaning. And so she certainly seems to have full faith that if Daniel is called, that he will be able to explain what's going on, that he'll be able to give an answer where these so-called wise men are not able. So that brings us then to the third section, the discerning prophet, Daniel's interpretation. Daniel is called, and he will indeed give an interpretation. So the king's request and reward. Verses 13 through 16, then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah." Now, I meant to mention earlier, but they keep referring to Nebuchadnezzar as his father. Again, back then, they used that term father in a lot looser sense than we do today. They would oftentimes use it for ancestors, maybe even several generations back. And so he's not his literal father. It would seem probably his grandfather. But it does keep referring to him as father. But Nabonidus is his true father in the sense we would use it. Verse 14, I've heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you. Notice, they haven't given up polytheism. Even though Nebuchadnezzar was learning, and as we looked at the end last week, after he'd been out grazing in the pasture with the cows, that he seemed to now recognize Jehovah is the one God. But again, this is a very polytheistic nation, and they're just regarding Daniel's God as a God, or maybe even there's many gods that are giving Daniel this ability, and that really seems to fit the wording here. But I've heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read the writing and make known to me the interpretation, but they could not show me the interpretation of the matter. Notice again, it's the interpretation they're having trouble with, not the writing itself. Verse 16, but I've heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. So he makes the same offer to Daniel that he's made to the wise men. If you can give the interpretation, purple clothing, royal clothing, the chain of gold, and you'll be made the third ruler in the nation, in the kingdom. Daniel's reply, verses 17 follow. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing of the king and read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. That's what we read about last week in chapter 4. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of the heavens, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart. Notice, Daniel's getting right in the middle of Belshazzar, isn't he? He reminds him of the things that Nebuchadnezzar had done, the lessons that he had learned. And you, his son, again, literally his grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart. Though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house you have brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see. Notice how he describes these gods, which do not see, or nor hear, nor know, but the God in whom your hand is your breath, in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways you have not honored. You're honoring these gods that are nothing, but you haven't honored the true God. You haven't honored Jehovah. So first of all, in that section we see that Daniel rejects the reward. He's not interested in the reward. Keep that for yourself. Give it to another. He's not really being rude, but he's showing that he has no desire for worldly gain. That's not what he's in this for. But yes, he will make known the interpretation, but he's not in it for the position or the gain that the king has to give him. But come what may, he will declare the truth, whether it's what the king wants to hear or whether it's not what he wants to hear. Things and power will not alter his determination of what this means in any sense. That the man of God is free from the bondage of such trinkets or such gifts, such bribes, you might say, to him. And so he promises to read the writing, to make known the interpretation. But first, again, he reveals Belshazzar's sins. He reminds him of the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, how great Nebuchadnezzar was. And also of the pride that he had, and how that God had humbled him. There's a great difference between the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. The kingdom by the time of Nabonidus and Belshazzar is not nearly the great kingdom that it was under Nebuchadnezzar. But even though he was not equal in greatness to his father, Belshazzar had become very proud and doing very prideful things. Nebuchadnezzar's experience related in verse 21, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdoms of mankind. That's what Nebuchadnezzar finally understood when he was out grazing with the cattle. And so Daniel reproves Belshazzar for not taking to heart the lessons of the past, not learning from the things that Nebuchadnezzar had learned. He says, you, his son, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, verse 22. Verse 23, you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. It was not just that the king was of a proud heart, but that he had flaunted himself against the Lord of heaven, sending and getting those utensils that he knew exactly where they came from and what the purpose of them was. And so there was no reason to do that other than to really flaunt the gods of Babylon in the face of the God of Israel. And that didn't go over too good. He praised gods, Daniel says, which do not see or hear or know. gods that are really nothing, gods that really do not even exist. But he glorified not the one true living God, the God in whose hand is your breath, the God whose are all your ways. You haven't given him glory. You've left him out of the equation. And so the proud king's night is going to end in death. But these words of Daniel graphically set forth the utter stupidity of serving idols, of serving those gods that man has made with his hands or made with his mind that really have no existence, that really can do nothing for man. Well, as we continue on, verses 24 and following, the riddle is read and resolved. It's really quite simple, the meaning of these things, as Daniel explains them. First of all, the reading of the riddle, verses 24 and 25. Then from his presence, the hand was sent. Whose presence? Well, he's been talking about God, the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways. It was from him, from his presence, that this hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And so this came not from the gods they were worshiping, from the God, but from the God that they were flaunting in the face of, from the God of Israel, the God Jehovah. And this is the writing which was inscribed, verse 25. Menye, Menye, Tikal, and Parson. And so he says the word was inscribed. It was sent by God. This is a message from God that's been given. It's written with the fingers of the hand, and just a hand only. The inscription, the words, Menye, Menye, Tikal, and Parsan. Again, those were words they knew. Those are in their language. They just don't know what it means. What is the message that this hand writing on the wall has? Well, then we come to verses 26 through 28. We have the resolving of the riddle, the explanation. This is the interpretation of the matter. Menye, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tikal, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. For as your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Pretty simple, isn't it? The explanation that Daniel gives. This is the interpretation of the matter. This is what the meaning is. All three of these words are words that had to do with measurements. And again, words that they would have been familiar with. But Menye, he says, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. And so he's numbered the length, the duration that the kingdom of Babylon is going to be in power. They're numbered. There is an end. There's a beginning and an end to that nation. And it's being brought to an end, to a finish. Tikal, he says, you, talking to Belshazzar and about Belshazzar, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting, lacking, deficient. You know, the old balances, you know, where you had the two little bowls or plates or whatever, and they balance, and you put a known amount of weight on one side and then put whatever you was weighing on the other side and see how they measure. Well, Belshazzar has been put in that balance, and he's come up short. He's come up deficient. And then Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. It's being taken away. It's come to an end. The word divided doesn't mean that the Babylonian kingdom is going to be divided between the Medes and the Persians. Just that it's being dissolved. It's being destroyed by the united effort of the Medes and the Persians. That was actually two nations, but they had come together in an alliance and were working together. So the deciphering of the characters can be obscure, but the interpretation that Daniel gives is very clear, very straightforward. time of the Babylonian kingdom has come to an end. You, Belshazzar, have been weighed. You come up short. The kingdom's being given to the Medes and the Persians. So the kingdom of Babylon is doomed. The proud king's festival will end that night again in death. So the defeated kingdom, the death of Belshazzar, the last few verses. Belshazzar keeps his word, verse 29. And he does make Daniel the third ruler. Daniel said to keep these things for yourself or give them to another. He goes ahead and gives them to Daniel. Verse 29 says, then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So he goes ahead and receives these things. Kings at that time were usually pretty good about following through if they made a promise, especially if it was before other people, because they wanted to save face. And so he does indeed go ahead and give Daniel these things. They wasn't worth a whole lot, especially being third in the kingdom, because the kingdom's going to come to an end within a matter of hours. But it also shows that he believes Daniel. If he had not believed Daniel, he would have probably had him put to death. But evidently he believes the interpretation that Daniel has given. And so he comes through with the gift that he has promised. Verse 30, he's going to be killed that very night. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. He said it's coming to an end. That very night, the king was murdered. Daniel's record noted that the festivities of the night were drinking, dread, and then there's death. There's this feast going on, then there's the terror of this handwriting on the wall, and then the death that takes place. There's no mention of a battle. You know, you would think when a world empire is going to fall, there would be some type of terrific battle that probably rages on for months or years. Daniel doesn't mention a battle whatsoever. Well, what do historians say? They tell us the same things. The city fell when a festival was being celebrated, history tells us. Well, that certainly fits the feast that's going on. The city did fall without a battle. Cyrus, the king of Persia, redirected the flow of the river. If you know about the city of Babylon, it was actually built to straddle the Euphrates River. Half the city was on one side, half was on the other side. The city, the Euphrates River, literally flowed under the wall and through the city. And Cyrus diverted the river and then was able to walk through in the riverbed and enter the city in that way. Historians also tell us that the king was murdered in his palace that very night, and even tell us the person's name. The soldier that murdered him, Barbarus. We have several sources that tell us those things. The Cyrus Cylinder, the Nabonidus Chronicles, several historians that have recorded these things, and so they're very well documented. Verse 31 then is a verse, most people say, well, it really should belong with chapter 6. But anyway, it's as our Bibles have been divided up, it's here at the end of chapter 5. It says, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And so, what's happened? It's being taken away from the Babylonians. Who's taking it away? God. The same God that's the ruler over the kingdoms of men, that reigns over nations and over lives and things that are going on in this world. He had set Nebuchadnezzar up, this great Babylonian kingdom. He showed him as the head of gold in that great image. But now it's passing from that to the second kingdom in that image, that one of silver, the Medes and the Persians. And how does it happen? Overnight, no battle, nothing. God has taken it away. He's given it to the second nation. Darius is actually not the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. Cyrus is. We'll read about him later. Darius is evidently one that was put over the region there of Babylon. But we'll read about him more next couple of weeks from now as we look at Daniel in the lion's den. I can't help but noticing as you look at Belshazzar, and this feast that he's having, and thinking about the foolish man in Luke chapter 12. Remember the man there who had made the great crops and he's built the bigger barns, and he said, you know, soul, take thy ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. That seems to be the idea of Belshazzar, doesn't it? He's eating, drinking, taking life easy, having fun, thinks everything's going great. But what did God tell the rich fool? This night, your soul is required of you. That was the same way with Belshazzar. That very night, his soul is required of him. And then who would these things be? Well, they're going to be the Medes and the Persians. And we'll, the sixth story then, the one again we're very familiar with, Daniel and the lion's den, takes place after the Medes and the Persians are in control. Lesson's yours. Is anyone here this evening who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation? That invitation is open. These lessons from Daniel aren't necessarily evangelistic in nature, but they do tell us a lot about God and about God's reigning in our lives and reigning in the nations of men. When we go to the New Testament, we see exactly what we need to do in order to be saved, to believe His Word, to repent, to confess, to be baptized for the remission of sins. If you haven't done that and are ready to do that, we'd love to assist you this evening. Maybe you've done that in the past, but you've strayed away, need to come home. We're going to assist you in any way this evening. Let it be known as we stand and sing.